National Council on Alcoholism in the state of Connecticut. Is that right? That's wrong. Well, anyhow, he's going to tell you about it himself. He told me another thing. He says he can write. He can read a lot about the stuff he's written, but that also has been proven a rumor. He can dictate. So I'm going to give you one of our dearest friends, the so vast and now and a great heartfelt piece of gratitude I have for him coming from the other side of the track, and which you have just as much gratitude due to him, Dr. Keeble. Keeble! The fight goes on 3 minutes before, and the red goes on after. Fire. The fate of the draw puts me in this position and not in Archie's, because I was originally scheduled to do the introduction. I don't know who's going to come out better, but I have some very strong ideas as to where I came out. 5 years ago at St. Louis, I acted as a representative of psychiatry. This year, I have a similar responsibility. It is a pleasant duty, and I appreciate the opportunity to address you again. The topic I have selected has interested me for many years. AA is faced with a dual responsibility. It first must bring its message to newcomers, and second, see that the message exerts a continuing influence upon its members. As I see it, when the message is truly received, a miracle is worked. Whether that change comes slowly or in a rush, the shift to sobriety is nothing short of miraculous. In my paper at St. Louis, I discussed the aspect of AA. I talked about hitting bottom, surrender, ego reduction, all of which contributed to the inner change which made sobriety possible. I also warned that the problem of keeping sober still lay ahead. Today, I shall devote my remarks to the concern we all have for the problem of maintaining sobriety once it is achieved. No one can afford to rest on his laurels. Sobriety to be preserved must be earned by good works and hard. Sobriety is never handed to one on a silver platter. This problem is of no small moment to all in AA. The years have passed, and the length of many members is stretched into a very respectable number of years. The question of preservation of the non-drinking state is increasingly before us as time marches on. The answer, as you all know, is not always favorable. Here and there, one hears and sees an old-timer who, after 10 or 15 years without trouble, is back once again in the rat race of alcoholism. The number is not alarming, nor do I think it represents a trend. But it happens with sufficient frequency and apparently over a wide enough area to make it a matter worthy of serious concern and consideration. My paper will have three sections. The first will present my understanding of the workings of the AA program. The second will describe the foe of sobriety, the ego, and how it may be identified. The third will discuss humility, which is the arch opponent of the ego. On the basis of these three sections, I shall endeavor to offer some comment on the AA scene. The first section has to do with how sobriety is achieved initially. Here I shall repeat much of what I have said before about hitting bottom, surrender, and ego reduction. Summarizing my thinking, I believe that the person, if and when he succeeds in becoming a member of AA, has first undergone a conversion or personality change, which has occurred because he has second, hit bottom, which has produced third, a surrender by his previously entrenched ego. This can be put into something of an equation which reads, hitting bottom plus surrender equals conversion of personality change. And basic to all such thinking is the fact that in this new state may be found the capacity to feel and to have humility. What then is this ego, this false sobriety? Without going into a long technical discussion about its source, let me in this second section give you some feel for the inner attitudes I have in mind about the nature of this ego, which is the villain in the drama of the alcoholic. To start with, let me illustrate my ideas with a story which goes back a number of years. The dangers of ego, in the sense I am using it here, were just becoming apparent to me and to some of my patients. One day, one of them said, "You know, I just heard X say something that has been bothering me like the dickens. I wonder how you feel about it." He then added that he, my patient, was at a meeting with X in which they were discussing the program, and that X had stated he would only speak if he were the third speaker. Continuing, my patient said, "That sounds suspiciously like ego to me. What do you think?" I agreed. But we both found it hard to believe, because X was the spark plug and leading light of his group and as solid an AA citizen as one could imagine. Yet within a year of his boldly claiming this special spot, this man was drinking. And in 2 years, he was dead of complications brought on by his continued use of alcohol. Obviously, this man suffered from a case of big shotism. As most of you fully realize, egos in AA a dime a dozen. I can say along with Archie, you know, on the other side of the fence, too. Many of them are out in the open. They constitute the power boys, who often get things done, but just as often are the cause of endless headaches because of their very forcefulness. They are not noted for their patience. Of equal importance, and certainly of far greater frequency, are the individuals whose ego is even hidden from themselves. The following incident makes its point quite simply, I think. It concerns a patient who had been protesting vigorously that she couldn't have a big fat ego because she loathed all persons who showed any evidence of that kind of thinking and feeling. That she had no use for anyone who thought herself or himself superior, putting on airs as though he were among the blessed. After she had finished proving that she was not ego-ridden, I asked her a couple of questions. The first was, "Which way do you look when you loathe someone?" After some wiggling, she said, "I look down." I then asked her, "Where does that put you?" The answer was an explosive up. There was a long pause, and the patient began to talk. "My goodness, you can feel up about not being up. That's an awful fact. Where does this thing end? How can you be sure about anything you feel? Do you kid yourself like this all the time? Gracious, you're not as smart as you think you are." Then a pause, adding, "Are you?" And she looked at me questioningly, with a note of humbleness in her voice. It was apparent that the wind had been knocked out of her sails, and that she had dropped way down from being up. She was having a first-hand contact with humility. For her, the word ego had taken on a new dimension. It meant no aggressive pushing ahead, but an inner state of mind in which her ego was in full flower, despite her conscious denial of its presence. It was marked by attitudes which on the surface seemed blameless, if not downright praiseworthy. Just like the snobs who abhor snobs, she found herself hooked with her capacity to look down her nose and loathe. Her ego had sneaked in a totally unexpected fashion. She was beginning to take an inventory that might be more than a list of words. She was beginning to feel some truths about herself. This is the ego which can cause one profound trouble. Elusive, disowned, its presence can be denied with the utmost sincerity. It takes considerable digging and large doses of honesty before this inner self can be reached. In its quietly stubborn way, it can ruin our best intentions. The sad truth is that the ego is always more visible in others than in ourselves. We can delight in puncturing the pomposities of others. We can laugh at the saying of the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, who had this gem to offer. He who feels tricked must have been a bubble.
Oh, wonderful.
We can recognize the wisdom of inflated egos, but all too often the target is someone else. When it is ourselves, our aim can be notoriously bad. The ego, then, is to be seen as a driving force which seeks to dominate and can feel comfortable only when it is able to maintain a non-underdog position. It may recoil at any obvious display of big shotism, but down inside, where the feelings count, it can be touchy as a sore thumb. It is not an accident that the members of my specialty are called head shrinkers. So it's nice to be on this side of the fence at this point.
Yeah.
My next task is to consider the evidence which shows that the ego has gone. That evidence can be summed up in one of two words, humbleness or humility. When either is present, the ego has departed. I make no effort to distinguish between these two words, using them as synonyms to identify a state of mind which has certain characteristics. The problem, basically, is how does one feel when one feels humble? The answer to that question lies in an understanding of what I call the state of being up and the state of being down. Both of these states are familiar to you all. When one is up, one is gay, cheerful, animated. A person in such a state may be up on his toes, in high gear, or perhaps up and at him. He is all for action, progress, improvement, getting somewhere, and is rendered acutely uneasy whenever his advancing is in any way impeded. Perhaps more than he knows, he seeks to make life a pink cloud. In a deep sense, he lives off hope, and any ingredient which keeps telling him that someday his ship will come in and his worries will be over. For him, surrender is a completely shattering experience, impossible to contemplate. It means renouncing the will to live, the force that keeps him going. The person in the upstate seldom questions its validity. It seems the epitome of health and well-being. Down, on the other hand, is the exact opposite. In the state of being down, the individual is not gay, lacks energy, drive, and finds life a dreary bore. Such phrases as down in the mouth, the down in the dump, successfully picture the down frame of mind. It is a state of mind to be avoided and smacks little of health. In keeping with most everyone else, for years I viewed the upstate with kindly eyes, and this down one to be the enemy of mankind. Then AA entered my life, and a whole new series of facts were forced upon me. I heard of a pink cloud, a state, if ever there was one, an upstate, if ever there was one, yet clearly not an entirely healthy one. And even more confusing, I heard of humbleness and humility, which were certainly part of a down state, yet were essential to sobriety. And finally, to my surprise, I realized that being sober meant being sober-minded, with no trace of being up. These were incontrovertible facts which seemed to fly in the face of all logic. Yet facts they were, and some sense had to be made out of them. The question was, how can one lose the upstate without plunging into a down, which is crippling and surely a miserable form of existence? The answer to that question lies in a recognition of the fact that the word down does not have to mean down and out. It can also mean down to earth. This down is a very real one, too. The down-to-earth individual has his feet on the ground. He can spot the pink cloud for the up element it has. and can distrust its airy and unsubstantial qualities. The man with his feet on the ground is a solid citizen, going nowhere, interested in nothing spectacular, but able to live each 24 hours as a contributing member of the human race. Here is a very different down from the depressed and happy sort of down which formerly has been envisioned. Here was a down which stood for substance, for lasting value, a down which could not be deplored. This kind of down meant health and real well-being, not the ephemeral kind, which lifts the individual slightly off this earth. Down could mean being humble and free from a lot of giddy notions about ourselves. It could mean the end of ego and all the unrest associated with that part of our nature. In a very deep and profound sense, down could mean that we were able to accept ourselves for what we are. No longer do we have to be up, looking down with scarcely concealed loathing. We are down and can look up, maybe even to a deity who has never looked down on us. We can now talk about humbleness. In the light of our discussion of up and down states, we can realize that humbleness is a down state which puts in its appearance whenever the individual descends and stops on earth rather than plunges on through to the lower regions. The humble person is down, but his feet are on solid ground. The former fears of what will happen to him if and when he drops from his high estate vanish as he experiences the comforting realization that he can let the gods fight among themselves. All he needs to do is to stay where he is and learn to live. In so many words, humbleness or humility is a down state which is livable and not a down state which is filled with rancor, unhappiness, and a constant need to escape from its strangling clutches. In true humbleness, the discontent, the restless urge to get away, all disappear, and an inner stillness makes its presence felt. The ego in the genuinely humble person is in abeyance, sufficiently so no longer to color the psychic picture, for the moment at any rate. It is accurate to say that true humility is the real evidence that the ego it has gone, or is no longer influencing the individual's thoughts or feelings. The next question is now clear. How can this down-to-earth state of mind, which is the real source of humbleness, be induced and then maintained? Both of these questions are worth inspecting. The first, how is humbleness induced, is of course known to you all. Hitting bottom is the key. It brings the individual into contact with earth, usually with a resounding flat. The use of the word bottom suggests quite neatly where the hitting is applied. For the fortunate, it can spank them into some measure of sense. The whole art of engineering the individual so that he hits the bottom is a fascinating matter about which to conjecture. You all can tell me more how it happens than I possibly can. You all have been through the mill and may have seen many others through the same rough time. Nothing I have to say will match your first-hand experiences to the nature of the forces within which finally produce a breakthrough leading to hitting bottom and surrender. Before this group, any extended discussion of hitting bottom and its role in producing sobriety is wasted time. Therefore, let me pass on to the much trickier problem of maintaining the down-to-earth sober person. It is one thing to knock a person off his pedestal. It is a much more difficult task to keep him from climbing right back on again. Here, perhaps, I have something to contribute, since a considerable portion of my practice is devoting to helping AA members develop their capacity to stay humble or down on earth. Out of my experience, 3 points seem to have particular pertinence for this audience. The first is the need to recognize that the ability to remain on earth is not under the control of the will. It is just as impossible to will yourself to be humble as it is to lift yourself by your bootstraps. The very effort to will humbleness is in itself an act of sheer arrogance. It is an attempt to dictate how one should feel. One can only hope and pray for the desired feelings to come along. One can just not order them to be present. The feelings have an independence which must be respected. The second point for consideration is that as people, we have forces within us which can carry us off Earth so subtly and so quickly that we are totally unaware, that anything has happened to us. The climb back on the pedestal can go completely unnoticed. The old-timer who insisted on the preferred position could still talk AA and be convincing to himself and others. My patient had spotted the returned ego, but the victim of that return was totally innocent of the fact. If so charged, he would flatly asserted his humbleness and would have been quite honest, although, of course, quite inaccurate. The problem of the unnoticed return of the ego is widespread. The individual who enters AA after hitting bottom has his own experience which provides him with a genuine feeling of humility. Then a tragic thing often happens. The memory lingers, but the humility slowly seeps away. Finally, the individual basks in the memory of being humble, but his ego has staged a comeback, quite without his having the slightest awareness of the truth. When this comeback has occurred, the individual can get up and say in all sincerity, "I'm the most humble man in this room." That statement, made at a meeting in Greenwich, received a salutary horse laugh, although the speaker was obviously puzzled by it. Perhaps later on, the impact of what he said sank in and brought him down a peg or two. Let's hope so, for his sake. The third point I wish to discuss about the problem of remaining humble concerns the actual ways and means by which humbleness is preserved. Taking for granted this automatic return of the ego, the question resolves itself into the problem of how to stop this process of ego reinflation. Obviously, no foolproof formula exists. The pitfalls are too many. Attendance at meetings, 12-step work, repeated inventories, improving our conscious contact with the higher power are all helpful and may be depended on in most instances. However, the unwary individual may get trapped in ways which he least suspects. Time does not permit a full discussion of many snares which lurk for the unsuspecting. One danger spot is so common and so pervasive that I must bring it to your attention. I refer to the ease with which we can surround ourselves with virtue. We all have the capacity to give ourselves A for effort and thus pat ourselves on the back, an act which feeds our self-esteem and furnishes the ego with a heady diet. A patient dreamed of doing what was right and followed that dream with another in which she saw herself all wrapped up in a lovely golden cape, a perfect symbol for the individual who is all wrapped up in herself, emitting a golden glow. Although not aware of it, she was in obvious danger. Any person so conscious of her inner glow would have no trouble planting a halo on her head, with all the inflationary aspects of such an adornment. Like many another, she was being forced to realize that with her, virtue was its own reward. Oh, how she loves to gobble up that reward. She can profess all the humility in the world, but down inside where it counts, she pictures herself in a golden cape. All she could do, as the impact of her dream was laid before her, was to smile a bit sheepishly and remark, "I guess it's harder to be humble than you think. You just don't know you have such silly ideas down inside of you. And the worst of it is, I'm afraid that you are telling me a truth about myself. I guess the smart thing to do is not to dream." I have no answer to this problem of giving ourselves A for effort. Like the snobs who abhor snobs, one can give oneself A for effort for not giving oneself A for effort. My advice to patients is to keep their fingers crossed and hope that this self-glorification does not take place. There is no conscious way of dictating that it will not occur. Awareness hopefully can be helpful. Beyond that, all one can do is to pray. Such uncertainty about maintaining humbleness may seem very unenlightening. It leaves one groping for answers, a state of mind which makes many people unhappy. Let me point out that the individual who feels that he has the answers must be very careful or he will be in trouble. To have the answers puts one right back in the driver's seat. Able to cope with anything and a far cry from being humble and aware that one does not know everything, nor need to in order to get along. In fact, one indication of humility is a willingness to forego absolute certainty in the consciousness that man's lot is but a humble one. There are many, many things he cannot understand and does not need to. A higher power does exist and can be trusted. The humble person can leave it to there. He does not have to be in on the know about everything. I now wish to make some comments on the AA scene in the light of my remarks about humility and its place in the life of the alcoholic. Having been alerted by AA to the significance of humbleness, I could begin to see it in a wider perspective. I could recognize that humbleness is not confined to individuals, that organizations may have the problem of keeping humble. AA is no exception. Succeeding where others have failed, it was logical for some members to assume that they had a special know-how which often made them act as though they were the only persons on the beat when it came to handling alcoholics. Such an attitude did not endear them to others who, too, were interested in helping alcoholics. In the eyes of others, the humility so much talked about seemed strangely missing. In fact, sometimes it was not present. Looking upon this fact, I realized that the group must be humble. They, too, unless it is very careful, can wrap itself in a glow, which makes it sacrosanct and untouchable. Any organization can develop notions which need correction. AA can well examine some of its attitudes and practices. How often have I heard members say, and I quote with some accuracy, "Our job is to help the drunks who come to us. What's the use of all this fancy New York stuff? We don't need any assistance from the outside. We can do a job right within our ranks. That's where the alcoholic gets his help. That self-sufficiency of those remarks requires no comment." For a long time, such thinking influenced a large and often vocal group among the AA membership. Coupled with that belief was a second, namely that the group could help and that anyone who did not help was himself not ready for AA. As a result of such thinking, the drunk who did not respond was written off as a poor prospect, thereby absolving the group from any responsibility for the failure to interest him in AA. Such absolving keeps the group's ego intact. This intactness, or really lack of group humility, has been less manifest in recent years. The reason for this change is time and experience. The years have shown that AA is not the only answer to alcoholism. Still, the best by all odds, it is by no means the 100% solution. Moreover, other approaches have their successes, so that AA has no longer a corner on recovery. In other words, as time passes, experience is taking the first flush off the rosy hopes which the success of AA had generated. Now, AA is no longer the one answer. AA has to take its place alongside of others who are concerned about drugs. AA must now accept a much humbler place than formerly, a much healthier position, since once one can recognize confreres, one can live with them on a give-and-take basis and perhaps absorb something from them. An important element in maturing is the ability to listen and to learn. Fortunately, the success of AA has, in a sense, served as its own corrective. Being the most promising of all remedies for helping the alcoholic, AA has had to bear the brunt of treatment, being asked to take on all comers and failing like everyone else with a very considerable percentage. It is now obvious that AA is the answer for some people at a certain time in their drinking career. When that particular time is reached, AA can serve magnificently and does. But we still face a whole series of questions. First, what about the people who have not reached that critical stage when they are susceptible and responsive to the offerings of AA? Second, has AA any responsibility for helping individuals reach that critical stage? Third, is that a job for others or for faith? And fourth, should AA both as an organization and through its individual members join hand with others who are tackling the problem? These questions were not asked to be answered, but to stimulate your thinking. I wish, however, to close my remarks with an incident from my practice which bears on the last question, the joining of hands with others. I shall tell how I was a part of a two-stage miracle. The recipient of those miracles was a man whom I saw at the insistence of his wife. He was reluctant, defensive, and even surly. But he did talk, revealing a picture of drinking which seemed pretty grim to me. Finally, at the end of the hour, he warmed up sufficiently to ask me a question. It was, "Do you think my drinking is serious?" Anxious to avoid any long lecture, I limited myself to the observation, "I'm not sure, but I'd hate to be in your shoes." The scene now shifts. It is 5 years later, and I am slated to give a talk at an AA meeting. As I enter the room, a man comes up to me, stretching out his hand and greeting, saying as he did so, "You don't know me, but my name is X, and I saw you over 5 years ago, and you told me you didn't want to be in my shoes." Enlightened by that, I said, "What's happened since then?" And he replied, "I've been in AA for four years, going on five. After our talk, I thought about what you said about shoes. In fact, I couldn't get it out of my mind. So 8 months later, I decided to go to AA, to an AA meeting, and I've been going ever since." Now, I submit that I must be a miracle worker if in one interview I get a person like that to join AA. Of course, it took 8 months before my miracle came off. And without AA, my miracle could have never occurred. At the same time, I insist that the miracle of AA would have not taken place if I had not fortuitously said the right thing, setting into motion some doubts and fears which resulted in him to his going to a meeting ready for the miracle of AA to work its blessing. Surely it was a two-stage miracle, mine mostly by luck, AA's because the path to help alcoholics has been carved out of the experience of you and your associates. Neither miracle could have happened alone. That man's rescue was a joint enterprise. Neither myself nor AA were self-sufficient. Without AA, my interview would have led to nothing but meaningless stewing and nothing else. Without my remarks, AA would have not seen the man and could not have worked the results it actually achieved. Each was essential to the other. The recognition of such mutual need is both ego-reducing and humbling. In pursuit of one's own interests and activities, is it easy to lose sight of others and go it alone? The fact that I, as a psychiatrist, am on this program is evidence that AA is mindful of its relationship to others apart from itself. Maintain the awareness that you are but one of the instruments whereby the alcoholic can be helped, and you will have no trouble remaining humble, either as individuals or as an organization. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tebow.
I glanced at the meeting.
Hello there. You know, we're getting more like the upper crust than ever Bill's here.
Bill, get up. Get up.
I tell you, I'm proud now.
Oh.
Tell him I got a cough, too.
Listen, Bill just can't help talking, so here he comes. As you know, folks, I've been kind of hedgehopping from one meeting to another, but I think myself fortunate to come in just in time to hear Harry say that we can do separately what we cannot do together. And although I'm sure he took no tone of reproof, he should have remarked, certainly, something on which I'm going to dilate tonight. God knows, of all people, we should understand that we are not self-sufficient. And when we think of our relation with medicine, in the first place, how through the wisdom and love and dedication of one physician, he supplied to this society its indispensable first step, this concept of this progressive, at that time, nearly always fatal illness. How he subsequently, in understanding and in love, medicated us. And the sheer medication of drunks is a boring occupation. What doctor would want to make a career of just sobering up drunks? Well, this one did. Because he loved it. And he has had his great successes. And each of these has been a person who had this kind of language of heart that we could understand. Nearly every one of these in their early years had been confronted by faith. And still it persisted. Many a doctor has said, yes, it works, I can't do it. Carl Jung said it. My Dr. Silkworth said it. You heard Harry say it. What they were really saying is that we cannot do in separation what we can do. So this is the synthesis from which, providentially, we have drawn these elements of strength from medicine, from religion, and out of our own experience. But now that we are a little spoiled with praise, I think, public applause for getting dried up and being better citizens. In a spectacular, yet still small way, a success. This brings with it a sort of an unconscious, phony attitude that maybe after all we did most of this, you know? You know, there isn't one darn original idea in AA, and in thinking about my talk for the night, I woke up with a start to the realization that I hadn't had an original idea myself in at least 10 years, maybe never. All supplied by guys like these, by guys like the preacher. Tonight I want to talk, too, about other agencies at work in this field. Agencies that we used to fear. God be praised, fear is diminishing. But let us never say, this is the only possible way. We cannot endorse these agencies, but we can be friendly with them. We can be tolerant of their errors and their follies, and they would be the first to admit that they have them. And they are earlier even on the pioneering scene than we have. And indeed, we are so glad to say that we evolved out of trial and error. So when they have trials and they have errors, we rather loftily criticize and we often stare. Maybe that's getting short-sighted. You know, this gent sitting there, Harry, now that's a fine way to address a psychiatrist, isn't it? Like the other pioneer doctors who befriended us in many senses, he's a man of greatness in spirit and action. And what he did for us has taken a lot of sheer guts. And considering his condition, his training, his experience, for him to say to a gal in the sanitarium where he then was, take a look at this book. It isn't in print yet. The gal looked at the book. It made her mad as hell, and she threw it out the window and got stooped. Then, Harry, take another look at the book, dearie. She's dead. She saw one sentence there. We cannot live with resentment. While it was true at that time, we certainly since proved that false. At any rate, that was the word that triggered her to go down to our little meeting in Clinton Street. And in the place, the sanitarium at that time was a poor little rich boy. And he was floundering around. And the gal we know as Marty came to the meeting at Clinton Street. And she came back with that remark, which will always stick in our annals. Said she to her boyfriend, "Granny, we aren't alone anymore." And when Harry saw the effect of this...
That's a very significant remark. Held up our hands through thick and thin. On the race. Probably more than any individual has caused the general medical profession to roll out the carpet for us. Red carpet, double thick. Never swallowed. Came to St. Louis. The same kind of deep interest, which goes far beyond techniques and medication, and goes deeper than friendship. Such have been our plans. Such is the great tradition they have established. We said last night that it was good for us to look at examples of greatness in spirit and action. So, just have another good look right here and think of all of our other friends. You know, it says in the opening, the preface of the A book,
And we put it there so long ago as 1939. It seldom knows, but I guess it's right there. It should be. It says that this society holds itself wide open to any legitimate scientific investigation. I hope we do this. We know our illness to be an illness of the soul. Well, sky pilots especially. We know ours to be an illness of the emotions. Well, psychiatrists are specialists. We know ourselves to have an illness of the body. And your general practitioner is a specialist. And we also have some more specialists. We have people called researchers. And they are biologists and biochemists. And while our share in this is a spiritual approach, I think more and more that spirit, mind, and body are coming by all who study it to be regarded as the several aspects of a single unit. So, how do we know what's going to come out of a test tube? How do we know? We know that some damn bad addictive drugs have come out of test tubes, but why in God's name clobber these fellas for their trial and error, the very thing that made us? What next? Let's be loving. Let's be open-minded. And supposing that some of the stuff doesn't agree with us, but it agrees with the rest of the population. Well, we don't have to swallow it, you know. So let us take a loving look at all who labor in this and related fields, that they may too be glad to carry the message and lend a hand to the end, that we can do far better together than ever shall we do in separation. Thanks.
You know, I'm mighty glad I don't have to practice humility. I'm proud as the dickens to have been able to introduce Bill. I'd like to be proud again and do it. You know, I was thinking when Dr. Thiebaud was speaking that I could have summed up the second part of his speech much better than he could, because I know all about the psychiatry stuff, you know. And it's summed up in a very beautiful poem, which goes as follows. See the happy morons. They do not give a damn. I'm glad I'm not a moron. My God, perhaps I am. I think that's a darn sight better summing up than that stuff, you know. If you look at your program, you'll see that the next speaker is stated as being in Texas. Well, the lady there, well, that's a damn lie. But so many of these things the Alkies tell you are lies. He got tired of Texas and moved to California. And I never heard of a Texan moving to California before and boasting about it. He did it, though, today at lunch. He used to be at this... What is... I never can read these fellows... Oh, yes, that's it. You know, I thought I was doing something smart by writing, making them write their own biographies, but you can't read what they write. That's why they write on the prescriptions that way, you know. Little lectures and stuff like that. Anyhow, the druggists don't follow it, it's all like that. He comes from the... He was in the Pelo State Hospital in Pelo, Texas. And he was did the psychiatry business there. He explained at lunch he was awfully sorry for the poor fellow because he'd never studied psychiatry, and I explained to him that Harry Thiebaud had, and look what has happened to a lot of his patients. And then he said he was nervous and speaking. Well, I said, physician, kill yourself. You ought to know how to do this. And now we're going to hear from the opposite side of the track of Harry Thiebaud and me, and that is from Dr. Hal F. Of California. Archie, there seems to be some confusion about my heritage, and I just want to get that little matter straight right now. That's the Texas State flag. There's a reason for carrying that little baby around with me. Let me start off by saying, hi, everybody. My name is Al. I like the way you introduce yourselves out here. You know, when I looked this program over and I saw Dr. Thiebaud and Dr. Hal and Dr. Bauer, somebody asked me, how do you feel about it? And I said, well, it's like going from the Busch Leagues up to play the Yankees in Yankee Stadium on a Sunday afternoon. If that's what they want me to do, I'll take a whack at it. I'd like to point out in the beginning that all of us who have a degree doctors are not necessarily doctors of medicine. I'm going to tell all my... I want all my friends to know this is my old trademark story. If you want to go home, you can. But not all of us who have the degree doctor of medicine or doctor in front of us are named or doctor of medicine. Some doctors do different things. For example, there are doctors of veterinary medicine, and these gentlemen are very skilled in their arts, and they're rightly called doctors. And to put myself at ease, somebody asked me before the meeting, they said, how do you feel? And I said, I'm nervous as a cat. And he said, why don't you take a tranquilizer? And I said, no, I'm an alcoholic. I have to go with cold turkey. So, you know, before I want to say something else. You know, before I got in this thing, I used to think of myself as a doctor who just happened to be an alcoholic. I think of myself now as the alcoholic who just happens to be a doctor. It's a big difference.
Oh, that's good. That's
nice. Seriously, I want to tell you about this doctor of veterinary medicine that we had over there in Carroll because he works a great wonder. And in telling this story, it'll do me a lot more good than it will you. It'll relax me. There was an old farmer outside town there that had a horse of which he was very proud. And this horse was known far and wide for its ability at stud service. Certainly a part of this gentleman's pride, as well as his economic income, was acquired from the stud service of this horse. And then one day, this horse stopped doing what horses have to do to get their fee for stud service. Well, this was not only a blow to his ego, but also to his pocketbook. And he tried everything that he could think of, and it proved to be of little or to no avail. And so one day, he came into Terrell there, and he consulted our local veterinarian. And Dr. Lewis said, well, that's very simple to fix. He went in the back of his shop, and he got some pink powder, which he promptly put in the poke. And he said, you take this home, and you put it in your horse's feed. So the old farmer did as Dr. Lewis suggested. He took this pink powder, which he promptly put in the poke, and he took it home, and he put it in his horse's feed. And when in a few days thereafter, this horse was again doing what horses have to do to get their feed for stud service. After this had all transpired, our farmer was downtown on a Saturday afternoon, sitting in front of the bank, talking to one of his contemporaries, whittling on a stick, and he's telling him all about this marvelous pink powder and what it had done for his horse. His friend looked at him and he said, say, what was in that pink powder? The old farmer said, I don't know, but it tasted like peppermint to me. You know, it's been a trademark, too, with me when I get up to one of these AA things to take a little crack at the psychiatrist. It helps keep my wheels in balance. And I'm reminded about the story of the fellow who went to see the psychiatrist, and he said, "Doctor, I've got a problem." And the fellow said, "What is your problem?" He said, "Doctor, I'm in love with a horse." The doctor looked at him for a minute, and he says, "Well, that's not so much of a problem, young fellow." He said, "I'm quite a fancier of horse flesh myself." He said, "As a matter of fact, I've got my own stables. If I can get away this weekend, I'm going to Santa Anita." The young man looked at him and said, "Doctor, this problem is very serious. I'm not only in love with this horse, I'm physically attracted to it." The doctor took out his pad and pencil. He said, "I see, this is serious. Tell me, is this horse a mare or a colt?" He said, "Doctor, I know I've got a problem, but I'm not clear." And then there was the one about the fellow who went to see the psychiatrist. He says, "Doctor, I don't know what's the matter with me. All I do is dream about baseball." The psychiatrist looked at him. He said, "Doc, you mean tell me you never dream about girls?" He says, "Oh, no, I can't do that." He said, "Why not?" He said, "I might lose my turn at bat." Oh, this could go on all night. I feel a lot better now. My name is Hal, and I am an alcoholic. All right. Down in Texas, where I took what I hope and pray to God will be my last drink of beverage alcohol, we have a tradition. And since I hope and pray that my sobriety date will continue to remain the same, I'm going to observe that Texas tradition, and that's why I brought my little baby along. Down in Texas at an AA meeting, when we introduce ourselves, we say, as I'm going to do, "My name is Hal, and I am an alcoholic. And by the grace of God, and through attempting to follow this 12-step program, and with the help given to me by people just like you," and in my case, I add this because at least for Hal, I know this is true, "with the help given to me by my wife, I have not had a drink of alcohol in any form in 4 days, 1 week, 11 months, and 3 years ago today." Good. We don't brag about our sobriety in Texas, the hell we don't. This is one part of our ego that we're going to keep, Doctor. This is the way we do it down in Texas, and we've got some good AAs down here. But I'd like to point out in saying this that there is another aspect to this, and I like what Doctor said about humility. We do it one day at a time. One day at a time. 24 hours at a time. When I got up this morning, I made my contract, and the good Lord willing, when I go to bed tonight, I will say thank you, God, for another sober day. Now, I am not one of those people who indulges in the theory that I was a born alcoholic. However, I do know with some relative degree of accuracy when I crossed that so-called invisible line between social and pathological drinking. It occurred rather quickly for me, and it matters certainly no more than a few months. In the early part of 1952, I was practicing my particular brand of medicine, which happens to be one of the surgical specialties in Northern California. I had been certified as a member of the American Board of Otolaryngology, and I had been made a member of the American Academy of Ophthalmology and Otolaryngology, and I had just recently been certified as a member of the Pacific Coast Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Society. And in the spring of that year, my application was on file in San Francisco to be a member of the American College of Surgeons. At the time, I had a temporary appointment to the University of California School of Medicine as a clinical instructor in the field of otolaryngology. And I had been promised that as soon as I was certified as a member of the American College of Surgeons, that my temporary appointment to the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco would be made a permanent one. I'd be a permanent clinical instructor in my particular field. I never got to be a member of the American College of Surgeons. And the reason I never got to be a member of the American College of Surgeons is very simple. I crossed the line between social and pathological drinking. I crossed it so quickly that instead of going to the meeting of the American College of Surgeons in San Francisco to be certified as a fellow, I ended up on the floor in a locked room State Hospital at Napa, under a commitment. That's how fast I crossed it. My good medical colleagues, my friends, my contemporaries did not know what had transpired, and they thought probably justly, that I had gone insane.
and they had me committed there. Frankly, it took a damn good lawyer and a hell of a fee to get me out of it, too. But he did. But from this point on, my story is the same as any other alcoholic story. I had departed from the path of normality. All those phenomena began to occur to me that I had heard you, thousands of you, tell me about and share with me at AA meetings and groups and sessions all over the country. I began to experience that phenomena of the morning drinks, the blackouts, the shaky hands, the stomach that would not take food until it had a drink. And from this point on, my story is no different than yours, except for time, place, and what happened. But being a doctor of medicine, naturally I turned to my own profession for help with this illness. At that time, I think I had a rather peculiar notion about it. I knew something was wrong. I never considered myself an alcoholic. I had this idea kind of screwed up in my mind that this fellow God, I had never been an atheist or an agnostic, but this fellow God's an awful busy guy. He's got a lot of people to make. Schwartz and Henry Ford try to make automobiles, but he must use a somewhat similar technique. The only thing I could figure out about the time that my model came through on that assembly belt, somebody said, "Hey, God, just for a minute, you know," and he happened to look up. And he forgot to type some little nut, bolt, or screw somewhere there in my model, and I went through an imperfection. And I'd better get to one of these skull jockeys, these head shrinkers, these reflex detectives. Oh, don't kid them too much. They're our friends. What Bill said. That makes it so. I better get to one of these guys and get straightened out, because I was sure having a hell of a time with my drinking. So, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, I'd go see my psychiatrist. Now, I told my office nurse, on these days, no appointments, I'm going over and get my head shrunk today. I'd usually finish somewhere around 11 or 12 in the morning, and I'd go in and I'd pour out about that much ethyl alcohol in a beaker. I'd down that, and of course, I'd have to have a few goofballs, depending on my mood for the day. I'd spray my nose with a little cocaine, about 10% solution, and off up the street I'd go to see my psychiatrist. Of course, I'm taking treatment. I'm getting well. I've often wondered what we talked about. Oh, it's a lot of fun. You know, I'm going to say this. I've said this before, Harry. I don't think Sigmund Freud could help me. At least the shape I was in by the time I got to his office. You know, this sort of idiotic thinking, though, this is typical alcoholic, looking from the problem, looking for help and turning the wrong sleeve, the wrong thing over. I decided there was nothing wrong with me. It was the psychiatrist. He wasn't doing me any good. I told one of these big psychiatrists in the big city. About 6 weeks at the Langley Porter Clinic in San Francisco. Now, I don't know whether some of you Easterners are familiar with that, but it is an institution of higher learning. I learned how to finger paint. I learned how to basket. I even gobbled around a little mud clay. But you know, it was fun. I was sober when I was in there, but on the weekends they let me out and I'd get loopy. But we talked about very interesting things. I'm still worrying about a few of them, but then it doesn't matter. But then I continued to have trouble. So I decided somebody told me about a psychiatrist in Philadelphia, so I went there to see this fellow. I left Philadelphia rather hurriedly. Two gentlemen in blue uniform drove me out to the airport and said, "Get on the next plane and go back to San Francisco and don't ever come back." And I haven't been back to Philadelphia since. I did pull a fast one. After the cops left me at the airport, I went over and got on a plane and went to New York instead, and I looked up a psychiatrist there. I could name some names. I could drop a few names. I'll tell Harry about it. But these gentlemen ought to remain anonymous. Of course, they are top drawer men. This fellow was chief at Cornell, you know him. They were wonderful men, but as they say in AA, I guess I wasn't ready. We had a lot of fun, though. It's like my friend Joe would say about that wedding in the bed. It's an end result, not a symptom of drinking. I learned that from Joe, not from a psychiatrist. One cannot continue to pursue the candle like the moth does the flame of alcoholism, as I did, and not pay the penalty. I paid. I became the victim of the third stage of this illness, the convulsions of the DTs. My favorite episode of hallucinations is to have a Dixieland jazz band playing in my ears night and day. One does get tired of it after a while. I became addicted as a result of my alcoholism to all sorts of agents, damn near anything. Goof balls were my particular hobby. I loved those things. I did. And I liked formaldehyde. I used to lay down on the floor. I could get up a pretty good crawl just to get the doctor to give it to me. I got to be one of these commuters, you know, to go to the hospital for what? To get sober for what? To go out to get drunk for what? To go back to the hospital again. Insanity. You know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with a rather unique distinction. I have 2 degrees. I have a certificate from the state of California, which I paid rather dearly for, to prove I'm not insane. I don't need that second step. And then later on, I was committed in my own native state of West Virginia as an alcoholic, and I had to stay there till I got a cure. The state law required it. 3 months after I was cured, I was in your city jail over here, Lincoln Heights. Time does not permit, I'm afraid that red light's going on any minute. Time does not permit a cataloging of all my drunken episodes, and I don't think that's the purpose of AA. We must qualify ourselves, and to be brief, I made Lincoln Heights 3 times in 1 day on a drunk charge. By the way, are there any alumni here today of Lincoln Heights? Let's have a show of hands. Look at them. To you Easterners, Canadians, foreigners, and people who've never been in sunny Southern California before, Lincoln Heights is the big Bastille we put the drunks in over on 19th Street over near downtown L.A. And I made it 3 times in 1 day in a drunk charge. It's not easy to become an alcoholic. It's damn hard work. I used to have to hunt real hard for those pop bottles that I'd go down and turn in for a bottle of wine. And that's what it got to be for me, seriously. I got to be the Skid Row wino type of alcoholic before it was over. And one day, a gentleman came to call on me. He found me in an old rooming house out in Hollywood, California. There's a Skid Row out there, too. You don't have to be just from Fifth and Main. And he said, Doctor, we've mailed you, I don't know how many copies of this document, but we haven't been able to find you. They all come back, left here, no forwarding address. And so they sent me out to serve you with this officially. And when I opened up this rather ominous-looking document, the first word that greeted me was very interesting. It was subpoena. And when I read a little further down in this document, I found that the Board of Medical Examiners of the state of California was charging me with unprofessional conduct. Now, here I am standing there in an old wine-soaked T-shirt. The seat down my britches. I have no socks on. I don't remember when I'd taken a bath last. My hands are shaking like this because I can't find that bottle under the bed. And I had 3 or 4 days ago the beard on my face, and I look this church in the eye and say, how dare they? How dare they charge me with unprofessional conduct? And that flop house on Hollywood, and over in Hollywood. This is the idiocy of this disease. If only God could give us the power to see ourselves as others see. I managed to get down with the help of the gentleman who became my sponsor to meet the Board of Medical Examiners. And I found out that they were very serious about this business, about my drinking. They had a copy of my police record there. This can be very serious when one looks at it sober. And I realized that unless something were done, that I was going to lose my license to practice medicine in the great state of California. So rather reluctantly, with no place else to go, I submitted. And there's a difference between submit and surrender, as Harry so well pointed out in one of his papers. I submitted to Alcoholics Anonymous for a brief period of time here in sunny Southern California. I had a wonderful sponsor, and God bless men like that who stand by. I submitted to this brief period of AA here in sunny Southern California long enough to get one of the greatest dividends that this fellowship has given me besides my sobriety, and that is my wife. Somebody, they tell me, asked Bill one time what was the most important thing in AA. And after a moment's meditation, they say that Bill said, "Your reason." I stayed sober 3 months to get that gal to marry me. And she did. And shortly thereafter, I went back to drinking. I didn't blame anybody for my drinking except the obvious thing, not me. I blamed the state of California and that board of medical examiners. How dare they do this to me? A certified surgeon in my specialty. A great genius, as Joe would say, unrecognized. So I said to myself, I've got a license in Texas. Everybody knows about Texas. It's the spirit of the West, the spirit of the Alamo. I knew if I kept getting drunk here in California, what was going to happen? They were going to put my license out from under me. So I said, all right, Karen, we'll go to Texas. You know how it is, all these Western doctors on TV, they drink all the time. Matt Dillon drinks with them, the sheriff drinks with them. They never put him in jail. I go where they drink like men. Well, when you start from here to Texas, the first town you hit is El Paso. And they got a jail there. I don't recommend it because I made it. And from there on in Texas, it was just to be the same darn thing over again that it was in California, because the problem was me. I. Not AA, not the Board of Medical Examiners, not you good people. It was here. And finally, we ended up, my wife and I, on Skid Row in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Literally there on Skid Row. My wife had had the last job that any of us had had at that point. I couldn't even hold a job, much less get one. I heard of a doctor deep down in the heart of Texas who was desperately looking for a surgical assistant, and on a chance, a mere chance, I put in a long-distance phone call, collecting there from that bar, and over the phone, he hired me. He'd have to be over the phone if he'd seen me and never done it. When Karen and I left Tulsa for Texas, our total worldly possessions were in one old footlocker. And besides our two bus tickets, we had 14 cents to our name. That's the way we went. And it was in Fort Worth, Texas, that I found the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous on July the 21st, 1956. And God willing, that is my sobriety. All I have to do is think about relatively what has happened since. You know, in an AA story, you're supposed to tell a little bit of what happened, what it's like now. And this what it's like now is the tough part. I haven't had a drink of any alcohol in any form since July 21st, 1956. When I came into AA, my wife had gone home to Oklahoma to get a job, to work up there. I had no job. I had literally nothing. The clothes I was wearing were clothes that she had bought on a trip to Fort Worth to see me and left with me. I think the money in my pocket was the money she'd given me before she went back to Oklahoma. I wanted her to at least be up there where she had a job and three square meals a day. But I found God in Fort Worth and AA there. And I found out a lot of things about hell there in Fort Worth with that AA group. But I didn't find them out the easy way. Doctor, you mentioned humility. When I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic and that my life had become unmanageable, but more important, when I accepted the fact that I needed a power greater than myself to stay sober one day at a time, I realized that there had to be a tremendous personality change in hell. And this was not going to be easy. The first job that I had as a member of AA was selling ladies' shoes. and I got that through another member of AA who helped me get it. I sold ladies' shoes for a living there in Fort Worth, Texas for almost 6 months. There's a little of ego left, Doctor. I'm sure there are those of you in this room that have more sobriety than I do. And I'm sure that there are you out there who work this program better than I do and have more peace of mind than I do. Any of you smart Baptists think you've got it made, try selling ladies' shoes for a living. I said this before, if I had been a successful psychiatrist the last 3.5 years, it's not because of any special training that was put into this dome of mine in some higher school of learning. It's because I had to learn to sell women's shoes for a living. I decided a long time ago, dear ladies, that there are a lot of you who can't afford a head shrinker. And you don't always say, well, I'll go out and kick the cat today. You say, well, I think I'll go down and try on a new pair of shoes. And here you come. If they ever take your license away, I'll gladly give you the secret of the trade. You have to be a good psychiatrist to sell ladies' shoes and make a living at it. After about 5.5 months of this form of making a living, thanks to the help given to me by some members of Alcoholics Anonymous who seemed to have a little faith, that the rotten egg had begun to perhaps change. I was recommended to the Texas Commission on Alcoholism for an appointment to one of the state mental hospitals where a program of recovery for the sick alcoholic was at that time in force, and where they were looking for a doctor who could administer to the alcoholic, preferably a doctor in AA. And by God's grace, I was chosen for that position. And during the last 3.5 years, as a matter of fact, up until just last Thursday of last week, I continued to serve at the Terrell State Hospital in Terrell, Texas, which is a mental hospital, and to which literally hundreds of alcoholics are admitted in one form or another every year. By God's grace, I have seen fit to give me various and sundry staff promotions, and I thank God for these because each time I got a little higher up the ladder, it didn't mean just more money in my pocketbook. It meant a little more position where I could do something for the drunk. And that's what I'm grateful for. Something that will come in there. And during the last 2 years, I have served as the chief of admissions to the admission and diagnostic unit of that hospital. In other words, if they bring some guy in, they say he's nuts. I sober him up and say he's an alcoholic. He's not nuts. I have the privilege and the right by the authority given to me by my superiors, and thanks to Al Badger and a few others for this help in this, to send that man not to the nut ward, but to the alcoholic ward. And I'm going to proudly say this, and this is a little ego showing, that the Terrell State Hospital was the first mental hospital in the state of Texas to open the door of the alcoholic ward and take off the lock on the doors there. I'm going to say this now. It proved so successful that there is not an alcoholic ward in any of the state mental hospitals in Texas today that has a lock on them. Texas is a big state, we've got a lot of nut houses over there. These are things of progress. In the spring of this year, through various channels, well, let me finish one point, if I may. What's the white light mean?
That means you've got 2.5 minutes.
All right. In the spring of this year, now, after I had been in AA about 8 months, I received word from the Board of Medical Examiners in the state of California that they were going to go ahead and revoke my license, which they had every right to do. And on about a certain date in the spring of that year, a hearing would be held relative to that. My sponsor learned of my admission and my acceptance of my alcoholism and joining AA, and he made a special trip to Texas to see me, and we learned about this. He made another trip to Texas, and I couldn't be there, so he made it a point to come back here to California. And when the Board of Medical Examiners met to revoke my license, my sponsor appeared in my behalf in front of that body. I think God spoke through that gentleman, because instead of revoking my license, which they had every right to do, having warned me, they saw fit to put me on a rather stringent probation.